My name is Jason Luther, and I'm Assistant Professor of Writing Arts at Rowan University in Glassboro, New Jersey. Those sounds you hear are from a digital recording of Victor's classic phonograph machine, the Victrola VVXI, or VV11. You can hear its mahogany lid being opened, the machine's crank being yanked and spun, and its two-spring motor cantankerously animating the heavy felt-line turntable. The Victor Talking Machine Company made nearly a million of the VV11s between 1910 and 1921 in Camden, New Jersey. This particular invention helped birth and sustain a musical public eager to purchase and play 78 RPM discs of brief acoustical recordings. All across America, living rooms played the likes of proto-country artists like Vernon Dalhart.
From Lynchburg to Damalan, a line on a 3 mile grade.
Classical pianists like Sergei Rachmaninoff. And early blues singers like Mammy Smith. The digitization and historicizing of phonograph recordings is the essence of my assignment, the Phono Project. As I mentioned in the introduction of this chapter, the idea for the Phono Project began in 2012 when I was a graduate student at Syracuse University. It was there where I taught a required research writing course that partnered with the radio program called Soundbeat. Soundbeat was, and still is, a 90-second show about the history of recorded sound. Its selections come from the Belfer Audio Archive, one of the largest audio archives in the world, which is housed within the special collections at Syracuse University Libraries. While Soundbeat draws from an archive of over 400,000 recordings, students in my class had to pull from the digitized archive at Belfer, which housed Edison cylinder recordings in the public domain. Once they found a recording in that archive, my students researched the recording for a 90-second narrative, writing several scripts, the final of which they committed to a recording through Audacity. From these demo recordings, writer and producer Jim O'Connor selected 5 to revise and produce for the show, which then aired in over 350 markets, reaching millions of listeners in the US, Canada, and the Philippines. Here's one from one of my students about the Jubilee Singers of Fisk University.
You're listening to the Jubilee Singers of Fisk University sing Peter on the Sea from 1927, and You're on the Soundbeat. Fisk University struggled financially from its very founding just 6 months after the end of the Civil War. On the verge of closure, the Singers began a series of fundraising tours in 1871. By appearing in many venues in the U.S. and embarking on a visit to Europe, where they sang for Queen Victoria, the Jubilee Singers broke color barriers and made an enormous impact on the world of music. Oh, and they saved the university. As a matter of fact, the Jubilee Singers continue to sing today. In their words, we stand on the shoulders of the original Jubilee Singers, continuing their legacy as we sing Negro spirituals. This episode was written in part by Syracuse University student Tisia Elder as part of the Soundbeat class partnership. For more on the Jubilee Singers, past and present, check out soundbeat.org right now. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Library. I'm Brett Barry.
At the time of our partnership, my research writing students and I were the first and only class working with Soundbeat. 6 years later, the class partnership is going strong as Soundbeat works with students in music journalism and ethnomusicology classes. As I prepared to redesign this course for students at Rowan University in the spring of 2018, I wanted to reflect on the 2012 partnership by interviewing both Jim O'Connor and subject specialist librarian Patrick Williams. Both Jim and Patrick helped build the original curriculum, and so we talked about key strategies and ongoing challenges with an assignment like the Phono Project 6 years after. One of the first challenges is deciding which recordings students can choose and where they come from. While I've provided several sites to use for the Phono Project, the partnership with Soundbeat was limited to its archive. That said, limited is a misnomer, as the Belfer Archive has nearly 500,000 recordings. One of the first things I learned then in talking with Jim is how he specifically limits students' choices when it comes to this process.
The pool that we have to choose from, the large pool, is obviously almost, you know, for our purposes, limitless. In terms of the demands that we want to put on staff and the work that they're kind of doing there anyway, what we've taken is kind of equal parts of cylinders, 78s, and vinyl. And what I do basically now, and I can't remember if this is how we did it, where I select a larger pool. Mm-hmm. The typical class size will be 20, and so I'll give them 40 choices and try and make it kind of representative of a month of Soundbeat episodes, mm-hmm. Where it's, you know, kind of that spectrum-wide range of genres and also formats.
Even with these imposed limitations to the archive, another challenge quickly emerges. How does a writer find a story worth telling in 90 seconds? A helpful place to start, Jim suggests, is the recording itself.
What I always, always say to everyone when they're writing these is to play that recording throughout while you're writing. Because I feel the music is so transformative that it automatically puts you right in that time and place when you're listening to that music. And when you hear certain, you know, if you hear the trill of a violin or something that kind of accentuates your point, you can really nod to that in your piece. And, you know, part of it's direction, obviously, as well. So you have to see yourself as the writer, the producer, and the voice artist. The most important thing for me has been putting headphones on and playing the song that I'm writing while I'm writing about it. You're locked in.
Once students are aurally familiar with a track and notice particular sounds or lyrics coming from the recording, they can begin to raise questions. That's when additional outside sources begin to play a role in the project. As Patrick notes, those sources can be invaluable, not only for understanding an artist's legacy or a song's resonance, but also for the larger cultural context that shape genres. Here, he refers to Vernon Dalhart's The Wreck of the Shenandoah, comparing the disaster song genre of the 1920s to more contemporary diss tracks.
Getting some of that historical context is really difficult. And the example I still almost without fail use in classes is that that Vernon Dalhart, Wreck of the Shenandoah, because it's like the collision of this, like, and this thing that we think of as like strange, you know, like this blimp crash. And then if you start looking at his catalog, if you start looking through the magazines of that era, you see that there's like, this is a type of song, like one of many songs about the crash of a train or a blimp or whatever. So looking at those historical resources that have lists of songs or have, you know, reviews or something like that can give students that context that helps them pick out what's interesting. And maybe it's not interesting that this is a song about a blimp crashing, but what's interesting is it's a song about one of many blimps crashing in our with music and recorded sound. We know what's that there's a bunch of like diss tracks or a thing for us. Like we understand that, but we don't see like somebody coming in 25 years picking out some particular diss track might not necessarily recognize that it's a part of this sort of cultural currency that exists in other recordings. And I think that if you just look at information around an artist or information around a particular track, you lose some of that and you're sort of forced to encounter it in these historical periods.
As Patrick's comparison suggests, researching and historicizing genres of sound are helpful for writing a strong script. However, as Jim notes, your audience and the very format of Soundbeat and sound writing are important considerations too.
The format is 90 seconds and you've got, you've got music in the background. It's radio, so it's not like you've got a captive audience.
Right.
People could be driving their car and a dog walks across the street, as we say in class all the time. And, and you know, people need to be able to recoup.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, complex points that you're making at the beginning of the episode to tie in at the end don't typically work. You know, the episodes that we write, some of them are autobiographical, so you have to come at it from that perspective. you know, you wouldn't say in a Soundbeat episode, Elvis Aaron Presley was born in Tupelo, Missouri, and, you know, people know that dude. So, you know, when it comes to a performer like Elvis, for example, it's more about telling not even a story. You know, you've got 150 words. It's more about telling a little chapter of the story.
Jim, Patrick, and I discussed other components of the assignment, how intellectual property structures the show's format, how students respond to their writing when they hear it on the radio for the first time, and writing for things like tone. However, it is the short form that is perhaps one of the assignment's best and most challenging aspects. I look forward to revisiting this again as I teach the assignment to a new group of students this spring at Rowan University. Thanks for listening. Once again, I'm Jason Luther, and you've heard a reflection on the Phono Project, featuring an interview with Jim O'Connor and Patrick Williams, both of Syracuse University. I'd like to thank Jim and Patrick for speaking with me and encourage you to check out Soundbeat online at soundbeat.org, where you will find several great examples of short-form podcasts written by Jim that you can use with your students.